Today's date is Monday, 28th of July, 2008, and I'm your host, Ogner. Today we are joined by special guest, returning guest, who is currently on holidays in Sweden and has been very gracious to give us some of his time and to discuss some issues, Israeli Jewish identity, 9/11. This guy is well known. He's a Russian born Israeli. He's an author, many books. His name is Israel Shamir. You can find him at www.israelshamir.net, and I'll have him on the phone in a couple of seconds, and hopefully we'll do a good little interview. And I'm joined by Israel. Israel, how are you doing? How's your holidays going?
Wonderful, perfect. Summer being, something that usually in Israel we are always afraid of it, because it's too hot, but when one is away for a summer, that's absolutely how it should be.
Absolutely. Making the most of it. So you've got a few weeks to go in Sweden. How's Sweden treating you?
Oh, Sweden is, wonderful, wonderful. Lakes are warm, and there are beavers in the river, and the forests seem to be nice. Basically, very, very pleasant countryside stay. Something that reminds me of some remote places in England.
Okay.
Something in the Thames Valley. A couple of years ago, I spent a holiday in Thames Valley, but also something similar feeling.
Okay. Well, let's give you a break. Listen, I'm going to start the first question I have for you, Israel. It's a huge topic on the internet. It got to do with 9/11, which is the dancing Israelis. What do you know about this, and what is the general feeling in Israel?
Well, dancing Israelis, that was a topic. As we know, on 9/11, five Israelis were arrested because they made some kind of movements which were understood that they were dancing out of joy.
Yeah.
And they look Middle Eastern, so they were arrested and taken away, and then turned out that they were Israelis, not Arabs, and they were released, I think, next day or in a few days. And some people see it as some sort of sign implying an Israeli connection. It could be and it could be not. Because in this particular time on 9/11, people were suspicious so much of everything that besides this call, they called on everybody who looked like anything strange.
Mm-hmm.
And did they actually dance out of joy or they did not? Who knows? I know of many people who did dance out of joy all over the world,
mm-hmm.
Not because that they felt those Americans had to burn in hell. But basically, American imperial arrogance caused many, many people in the world to feel quite happy that this arrogant power received the strike. That was the feeling of the great French thinker. He died a few years ago, Baudrillard. He wrote about it. Well, they did the act, but we all wanted it.
What about these so-called dancing Israelis that appeared on Israeli television in late 2001, and they said they were in New York to document the event. Have you seen this video clip?
No, that's something I don't know of. No.
This is because the reason I started with the 9/11, especially the dancing Israelis, is there is an open, an ongoing, very lively topics all over the internet about the Israeli Mossad and
involvement in 9/11. Yes, yeah. I know. I follow it on my website. There is a very, very big discussion about it on the very top. If somebody is coming to my website, www.israelshamir.net, you will see the very top item. That is very long discussion with a lot of people getting involved on this particular subject. Who did 9/11? Who didn't do 9/11? In my view, until now, we really don't know for sure who did 9/11. And I know that many, many people are convinced that it was done by George W. Bush or by Cheney or by Thad. But I say, you know, it could be, but it's not like we have seen anything really conclusive about it. There are many things that hint at this or other involvement, but none that looks really like a surefire proof to me.
Well, okay. If we can use this as a particular example, as I said, this show I'd like to talk about Israeli or Jewish identity. Now, for example, if you have a case of which is a huge attack on the world, not just America, on 9/11, if Mossad were involved in it, which is always difficult to prove. I agree with you; it's difficult to prove because they're sneaky. But if it became fairly clear knowledge that Mossad were involved in 9/11, as they were involved in many other things, how would that be taken in Israel? Is that seen as, oh, that's good, that's bad, that happens?
I'll give you another example so you will kind of see more or less to which extent the public is prepared for revelations of this sort. There was a program on Israeli TV, a soap opera, which was called The Battle Room. And it's all done as if it is about Mossad, about the Mossad agents. Some kind of, like, you have so many movies about CIA, and it is Israeli soap opera was about the Mossad. And one of Mossad agents comes into the battle room, into the war room, and he says, now we know that the Palestinian terrorists intend to attack on such and such day and such hour the Israeli ambassador in Paris, and they want to cut off his head and they want to kill his wife and children. What shall we do about it? And the head of Mossad says, well, we shall do nothing. What do you say? What do you mean nothing? Shouldn't we warn him? No, he says, he was a pain in the ass, this man. Let him die, hell with him, and it will make a lot of good feeling for Israel. So, you know, if it would be done by somebody else, not by Israeli TV, you would say, what an ugly anti-Israeli line is that? But actually it was done in Israel. In other words, people nowadays became so cynical everywhere, and they really expect their own secret services in every country to act in the most awful way.
I fully agree with you there. I wouldn't like my own country or my adopted country to be involved in all sorts of illegal shenanigans. I'm not so sure, but it's interesting, which is basically to get a feeling of I question the state of Israel personally. I'm very supportive of the Palestinian cause. Not that I have any love for Muslims or Catholics or any religion, but as the current situation. And it's interesting to get your impressions, Israel. I hear you have your bells in the background. I've just had.
Yes, it's a church. Yeah, yes. Church bells ringing. Very nice. Yes.
I can hear yours, and I just had mine. So there's a couple of seconds gap between Switzerland and Sweden. But
yes.
It's interesting to get your impression of what you're saying there about the general impression of the Israelis, which would be very similar to what Benjamin Netanyahu has said directly after 9/11 and again this year, that 9/11 was good for Israel. I mean, when people look at that, the words, maybe say, oh, that was out of context or whatever, but 9/11 was good for Israel.
Well, you know, absolutely, yeah, one can say that, that was good for Israel of Benjamin Netanyahu. It was good for his Israel. Let's put it in such a way. The position of Israel is unique, not because Israel is very strong or very good or very bad or anything. The position of Israel is unique because the supporters of Israel have unbelievable influence in the American discourse, in the American media. And in such a way, whatever happens, they can always present it in such a way that it would be good for Israel. You know, if, for instance, it would not be the case, for instance, influence of, let's for a second imagine what would happen if the influence of Israeli agents of influence would be, you know, minimal in the United States. Then you, some people would say, well, you see what happened because of our involvement in the Middle East. Let us make a reassessment of our policy because we really don't need this trouble. And some people would say something else. I mean, not obviously that it would come up to invasion of Afghanistan and whatnot. But because of whatever happened, the supporters of Israel succeeded to open huge anti-Muslim campaign all over the world. They used it, the 9/11, to their advantage. But in my view, they can use absolutely every event to their advantage, and every event which they do not feel is advantageous, they just eliminate it out of public conscience. For instance, so many Palestinian children were killed by Israeli soldiers. A lot. Hundreds of Israeli or Palestinian children were murdered. But, you know, they just disappear out of public conscience. People just don't hear about them.
Control them.
But whenever, whenever happens the other way around, it is forever spoken, you know. Movies are made about them. Concerts dedicated. Books written about. In such a way, events, it doesn't matter actually that much what event took place or did not take place. What is really important is what footprint it leaves in the public conscience. And here, in this particular point, the Israeli supporters, the Jewish influence in the United States is so huge that basically they can turn anything to their advantage.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there's no debating who owns, who controls the media in the U.S.
Exactly.
Which is, I mean, a lot of people, for me, that an English speaker living outside, living outside the United States, I find that, it's actually not. The more and more I do research Israel to see the power of the Jewish lobby, Israeli lobbies in Washington, but they've just opened up their first European lobby group. So I don't think there's many parts of the world that are sheltered from a very, very powerful Jewish Israeli lobbies.
Yes, well, I don't even know. Yeah, very few such places still exist. Probably they still exist, but, I mean, not very many, exactly. Their influence nowadays is fully globalized. And obviously, when there is such huge machine, and when it's so successful, other people also jump on the same bandwagon. So now you have people who are not Jews, but they are still fully in support of whatever Jews do, because they say, well, it's good for them, so it's got to be good for us. There was a very recent interview with the minister, with the French minister. It's a Muslim lady from Algeria, and she works as a minister in Sarkozy government. So she gave an interview and she said, the most horrible thing that happened, that is Holocaust. And she says, well, you know, we also obviously suffered. We had slavery. We had 1 million casualties during the war for independence against France. But that's all peanuts comparing what the Jews suffered. You know, with this attitude, you understand that that basically you don't need any more Jewish lobby. That success is already full.
But I think you hit a very, very key point there, where you have this Muslim lady talking about the Holocaust, because a lot of people question the 6 million.
Yeah, but you know, the question is not kind of 6 million, 2 million, 200,000, or whatever, or any other number. The thing to really question, in my view, is whether it is important. Why death of a Jew is more important than death of non-Jew? That I think, in my opinion, what we should not only doubt, but we should strongly refuse to accept.
Absolutely.
Like, for instance, now, last week, there was an interesting report. You know that during World War II, the German forces besieged Leningrad, what is today St. Petersburg, one of the two capitals of Russia.
Absolutely.
They besieged it for almost 3 years. That was one of the longest sieges that actually modern history ever knew. And hundreds of thousands of people starved to death. That was a terrible deprivation of the city. One of the most horrible pages of the war. So now Germany decided to pay some lump amount of money to every Jew who was at the siege of Leningrad, but not to any non-Jew who was starved in the same very way. That is, I think, something that one of those things that are so ugly that one can't really understand it. And in my view, such stories, they show that we should really accept not on question how many killed, how many not killed, but just whether it is possible even to put this difference, whether we should really pay attention to it. Maybe it is absolutely irrelevant, like we should ask question how many redheads died in World War II. Redheads, blondes, blue-eyed, dark, green-eyed, all of them very sad, everybody died. But I mean, we should not really ever agree to the idea that killing of a Jew or life of a Jew or death of a Jew is more important than that of anybody else.
Absolutely. 60 million died during World War II, but it's kind of been rolled around this 6 million and the Holocaust reparations and stuff like that. You're speaking, Israel, very openly about the topic, and I absolutely agree with you that I don't believe in this chosen people whatsoever. But would you, from my research into the financing of World War II, there's on both sides, manipulation, we were discussing there a little bit earlier on about Washington, I see the very same manipulation going on prior to 1930, all through the 30s, but prior to the outbreak of World War II, the manipulation of different governments and different states by what looks to be, from my research, to be by the private Jewish banking families.
Well, you know, naturally that those banking families would make business on anything, with anything, anytime. That's kind of, you know, the way of business. You know IBM did, and everybody did.
But Israel, to actually, what I'm saying is, I believe that certain Jewish banking families manipulated governments and countries to start the war with the idea of forming, that they had ideas of moving European Jewry from Eastern Europe to Palestine, and with the creation of the Israeli state in 1948. That I'm saying that I believe from my research that the plan was already in place long before World War II, and that was one of the aims of World War II.
Well, you know, what you speak about is sort of open, what they call, you know, open conspiracy. Because it's, basically, I mean, what you say is something that we all know. let's say there was an Evian conference where Germany and the United States and other countries discussed what to do with the Jews that Germany wanted very much to get rid of. That was before the war. And many countries actually volunteered to accept Jewish refugees. For instance, the Dominican Republic wanted to take 100,000 people, and so many others wanted to take. But the Zionist organization actually fought against it very hard. They say we don't want them to go anywhere, or Palestine or nowhere. So what you say, basically, it's obviously open thing. That's not really something that was planned somewhere in the secret, and we don't know, didn't know about that. That's something that was known all the way, that the Zionist organization indeed wanted the Jews to go to Palestine and not to go somewhere else. So about that, there is kind of no slice of doubt.
But Israel, my point is, you made the point earlier, whether it was 200,000, 2 million or 6 million, there were individual people. But the world, the entire world is on its knees to this Holocaust story still to today, and the example would have been your French, that French health minister that believes in it and bows down to it. And that's what a lot of people, even if you question now that that Israeli Jewish have a control over the US politicians, which is obvious. I mean, you have to be blind not to see it. They use this term, which is very prevalent on the internet and in real life, anti-Semitic and anti-Semitism, which is, I wouldn't believe that you use that term yourself personally, but I mean, that's absolutely, it's a knock-dead wall in your face when you go and try to do some research to put up this wall that you're an anti-Semite, or you know, you're into anti-Semitism, and that destroys people's careers.
Oh yes, absolutely. Yeah, sure. Yes.
But and how is for a non-Jew like myself to look into anything without, you know, seeing red flags going up? If you can, if you look into this, look into that, you'll be labeled something that you're not.
Well, it's very simple. It's and I'll give you how they do it. They do it by the question of attitude. Whether your attitude to the described event is positive or negative. For instance, if you say the Jewish people in the United States were very active on bringing the United States in World War II in order to defeat the Nazi monster, that is a perfectly legitimate statement from the Jewish point of view. But if you say the Jews pushed the United States into World War II, then this is probably an anti-Semitic statement, though they are absolutely the same word by word practically. But the question is of attitude, whether you think what they did was good or whether you think what they did was bad. Did I make it clear?
Yeah, that's a good example. I think a lot of people will say yes to both of them. Talking Washington, I refer to it jokingly, Israel as a state, as part of Israel now, because it's not part of America. Getting on with elections coming up, how do you see the elections coming up?
Well, you know, maybe my attitude is just plain wrong, but I'll put it in such a way. I feel that the choice, the election of the American president, is somewhat similar to the choice that some theater company people do over electing the first lover or the main actor to play the main character in a play.
Yeah.
So they say, so some say, you know, let this guy play Romeo, then say, no, let somebody else, John Dee play Romeo. But basically the script is written, and the play, we know what is the play. So obviously there would be some nuances if it would be this guy or the other guy who will play this part. The nuances could be different. But whether actually there is all that much big margin of freedom of action, action between the this or other American president. So that is something I doubt very much. And it's not really a question who of them is a good guy, who of them is a bad guy. But basically, we saw ourselves that it seems that the distance between the views is not all that huge. But obviously, there is very big difference in style. And Obama obviously appears much more sympathetic, much more simpatico than McCain, who looks really such a old warmonger. But whether it would make all that much difference as the bottom line, that's not all that much obvious. There are too many forces in the United States that want certain things, and whether Obama or anybody would be able to save himself, to get to to break himself loose from those forces, it's not sure. I'll give you an example. You remember when George W. Bush was elected?
Yeah.
You remember? That was not that long time ago. You remember it, yeah.
The E.T. when got elected, yeah.
Yeah, when he was elected, there was a quite, common feeling among many people that was defeat of the Jews. The Jews were... Yeah, do you remember it or not?
I remember the period very well. I followed that election very, very closely because I was into... I would have considered myself a right-wing, libertarian right-wing. I never... To be honest with you, Israel, I never heard that Bush winning was up the Israelis. I've never heard that attitude. I've never heard it.
No, that's why I'll tell you. Then if you were a righteous person of those days, you could probably Raimondo.
Yeah.
Raimondo, yes, the anti-war blog, very good, yes, anti-war site. On the anti-war site, a week after election, Raimondo wrote a very triumphalist article saying, Jews in the Bush cabinet, don't hold your breath. And said the Jews were defeated, and George W. Bush, that is the WASP victory. WASPs now are victorious. Jews are out. It's not like it was in the Clinton days when every second person in the cabinet was a Jew. Now that will be no Jews at all. That's what he wrote. I tried to recently to look for this item on the web. I couldn't find it. I think he was clever enough to remove it from the site because it was a little bit too embarrassing. But that's anyway how it was.
But I mean, this is, as I said, I'm trying to get a feeling of the mentality that if you look at the United States, you look at the election of Bush in the first year of Bush. We have the Project for a New American Century. We have all the neocons, and it is laced with dual passport holders, very, very pro-Jewish, very, very pro-Israeli stance. I mean, how is that perceived in Israel? Is that perceived as normal? I presume that's normal and good.
Well, in Israel also there are different forces, and all this huge rise of Jews in the United States to their supreme position and influence, that was something that many Israelis were very reluctant to admit, for some reasons of their own. And I'll tell you what is the reason. For a very long time, there was a part of Israeli mantra that Jews are safe. are only in Israel.
Yep.
That elsewhere they are bound to suffer. And all of a sudden, instead of suffering, they strike gold. You know, that was very, very big disappointment for Israelis, if you understand what I mean. It's like you have, for instance, a never-do-well brother who goes away to a big city, and you already prepare yourself that he will come back all broke, and you will feed him and tell him, I told you, brother, don't you ever go to the big city. And he drives back all of a sudden in a great Cadillac with three blondes around, and he says, well, hello, brother, I brought you some cigars from the big city. You understand that your attitude maybe will be not all that joyous as it should be, huh?
Israel, who in your opinion, who has the major power in international Jewry, including Israel, America, Europe, and where? What is the actual power structure of world Jewry? And I'm talking about politics, obviously.
Well, nowadays it is obviously the United States. I think that now there is no question that the center of Jewish power is in America. Now they have the biggest ascendancy.
And who are the groups we're talking about? I mean, you know who these people are. What sort of groups are we talking about in the United States? If, you know, to say that they're Zionists is a very general term. What are the names of some of these outfits?
Well, yeah, the word Zionist is obviously very general and very old-fashioned, and not many people describe themselves as Zionists nowadays. So that is a term which is more used, let's say, outside of Israel, because they don't want to say Jews, so they say Zionist. But in Israel, we rarely use this word. Basically, we see, looking from Israel, we see that the Jewish community in the United States is very big, very powerful, and obviously it has so many different groups, so many different interests, and on some points they can interact. On other points, they do not interact much. But usually they don't fight between themselves too much.
But, I mean, you must have read, Israel, I'm sure you have, you're well read, the White House kitchen has been kosherized, kosher kitchen. Now, who are the people, who are the rabbis, who are these people that have the ear of the president? Which group is this?
Well, I don't know if there are such rabbis that really have all that much access to president. I remember that some Chabad people had some access, and they presented some books to the president, and he met with them. But whether he actually meets them on any regular basis, that I doubt, and I never heard of such a thing. I doubt that there are some rabbis of direct ability to influence the president directly. It would be probably done indirectly, that they would be able to influence some of president's advisors, because the language of the rabbis is very different from the language that the President Bush is likely to understand.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that maybe I'm mistaken, but you know, even if it is made kosher, you know, there are some Jewish advisors who keep kosher or whatever, such thing could happen.
Israel, do you see how badly this is perceived? There's a separation of church and state, yet the kitchen in the White House is follows a particular religious philosophy. Do you not see that the American Christians can see a problem with that?
Well, yeah, they could, they could, and maybe they should, but I don't know whether they do.
The media is controlled, they don't know too much.
I think that meanwhile, American Christians, in their majority, are very much on the defense, and very much on the, let's say, withdrawing mode, rather than an attacking one. instead of asking, oh, why the kitchen is kosher, they will say, oh, why we still don't have kosher kitchen in our church? If by chance a Jew would like to walk in, and we would not be able to offer him a full kosher meal. That is, meanwhile, the American mentality of today. It could change tomorrow, but meanwhile, I think that's where we are. I think we should be realistic and see things, not only what we want to see, but only what we actually see.
Yep. If I can slightly change that, I don't want to forget about the people that are actually that are struggling on a day-to-day basis. What's the latest news from occupied Palestine?
Say again?
What is the latest news from occupied Palestine? I don't want to forget the people that are suffering on a daily basis.
Yes. There is, one interesting item of news that volunteers, some daring people decided to sail a vessel from Cyprus to Gaza. You know that Gaza is under siege, under naval blockade from Israel since this kind of famous Israeli withdrawal, and since then nobody can come into Gaza or leave Gaza. So there are some young people who chartered the vessel, and they plan soon to sail from Cyprus to Gaza to break open the blockade. That is probably one of those kind of really interesting things to happen. But whether it will actually take place, that's something that the future will show. Because a couple of years ago, there was a similar plan. And then their vessel, which was already primed for sailing, was bombed by Israeli agents. And that was it. They couldn't ever get enough money to fix it up or to sail again on another boat. So now we shall see whether they will succeed actually to depart and move. And then another interesting story over there. That is something that happens...
Yeah. Yes, Israel, you were saying there was a second story.
And the second story, as they say, that was also an interesting story, that the Israeli troops broke in and destroyed all the equipment in some schools and kindergartens in the West Bank, because they say that those schools and kindergartens, they are supported by the charities of Hamas. And Hamas, that's something that Israel, that's the present great enemy of Israel. So it doesn't matter that that's actually a kindergarten or a school, or whatever, they came in and destroyed, smashed absolutely everything that could be smashed. Another story that is very kind of current, that is also one of those summer stories, because there is huge water shortage in the West Bank. While every Jew in the country has water tap and shower and the possibility to get washed and possibility to get water, bigger part of Palestinians are not connected to water supply, and Israel doesn't allow them to connect. Very big.
I've seen that, and actually the refuge and the water and all the coming from these settlements is actually flowing into the occupied territories, and which is probably poisoning the local people.
Yeah, that's also obviously another problem. Yes, the problem is that they dispose of their garbage in such a way that it goes over the head of the neighboring villages. That's also very sad.
This is one of the reasons I'm highly critical of Israel. These people do not. There is no reason for these people to be suffering 60 years on.
Absolutely.
Listen, if I get back to this Israeli or Jewish identity, there is, on the internet, there's a lot written about Jews going back, thousands of years, where they seem to be chased out of everywhere. What is there, in your opinion, this idea of supremacy among international jury, whether it be the Americans or in Israel, that they are better than everybody else?
That is something similar to what the Americans had, let's say, in the beginning of 20th century, when they spoke about the manifest destiny. So eventually Americans succeeded to get rid of it, but the Jews not didn't get rid of it yet.
Yeah.
Well, this is obviously such very kind of atomistic feeling, but I must admit that there is nothing that a couple of military defeats can cure you of. A military defeat has a great advantage of clearing this dross from your mind. And I remember, for instance, after the military defeat of 1973, in Israel, there was no feeling of superiority at all. Actually, other way around, there was a feeling that we should really, you know, come to terms with the neighbors as fast as possible, while kind of whatever good lasts. So basically, that is, I would not kind of build too much on how much it is inbuilt, though it is obviously inbuilt to some extent, but external circumstances are liable to change it very fast.
Well, Israel, what about books like the Torah and the Talmud?
Yes.
So, I mean, people can say, you know, this has been an attitude of the Jewish religion going back thousands of years. I mean, it's written in the books. Everyone that is a non-Jew is a goyim, and there's different laws that you can see. Remember, even this famous case that was quoted in a New York paper where a leading rabbi was asked, was it okay for somebody to steal the organs of a non-Jew if it would help a Jew? And he said, yes, it is written in the Talmud.
Yeah, there is such a view. Yes, that was said by the rabbi whose name is Yitzhak Ginsburg,
yeah,
and he teaches in a settlement not far from Nablus. Yes, obviously. Let us understand that it's not sort of a general opinion. It's in a way certainly an extremist opinion. But yes, such opinion still exists and still can be founded, though obviously it sounds quite awful.
Well, I mean, there is an impression that, you know, this actually when people why have people chased the Jews for 2,000 years? Is, or what is the general perception from a Jewish point of view, an Israeli point of view?
In my view, the Jews weren't chased all that much during the last 2,000 years, but basically Jews were always rather prosperous minority, doing things rather well. Had their own go of troubles, but surely not more than anybody else. Obviously, you can tell a story of woe and misfortune about absolutely everybody. You take Rockefeller family, and you can tell so many horrible stories about what they suffered, or Kennedy family, so many of them were killed, assassinated, and all that. But if somebody will tell you that Kennedy family is a sort of story of woes, probably you would laugh at it. We should understand that this narrative of suffering is basically just a narrative. And somebody else can say, basically, it's a story of a very successful strategy of people who are basically almost always doing very well. If you go, for instance, from Switzerland, if you go to Spain, You will find that the Jewish quarters are the most luxurious ones, always located next to the royal palace, with wonderful streets, great houses, wonderful gardens and whatnot. In other words, one can obviously find enough trouble if one looks back. But basically, if you just look at on the material level, I don't think that the Jews had it worse than anybody else.
Mm-hmm. Okay, is there the current situation? Because if we switch over to East Jerusalem, I know your philosophy is a two-state solution. I can't see East Jerusalem ever becoming under Arab control, not at least in my lifetime.
Well, I also doubt that the country that Jerusalem will be divided. But who knows? There is nothing totally impossible. It is difficult to believe that it will happen, but who knows? Would be difficult again without a military defeat or something bad enough to happen. But if situation will change greatly, then it is possible. But in my view, obviously, it is better just for everybody to live happily together ever after, and not to try to rebuild another border when there isn't one.
Absolutely, and they get rid of this. I think I read today somewhere that the Israeli government have agreed to spend 50 million shekels to move a wall to allow 2,800 Palestinians to return to their land.
Yes, that's very kind of nice, very kind of positive development. It took 5 years of weak demonstrations, of a lot of confrontation, with a lot of people being wounded over this time, until now, Gabi Ashkenazi, who is the Israeli military commander, he said, the army really should not get involved in it, let the government decide. And until this very moment, actually, the government was hiding behind the army decisions. The government used to say, well, the army says it should be, so we can't do much about it. And the court, Israeli court, that is basically always doing what the army says. They also never argue with the army. They said, yes, sir, went on. But now this new commander, he just said, well, really, what's enough? Let the government take decisions. We are just soldiers. And immediately all this went down. That obviously was very entertaining.
And this new guy, Ashkenazi, he's just been to Washington. He was in Washington last week.
Yes.
So I was wondering if he's taking orders and finally someone making some sense and said, stop this senseless shooting of Palestinians.
Well, let's kind of wait and see. Maybe that's also a possibility that he found that the army got overextended by being bothered every week on the same spot for 5 years. Though it's not obviously something that bed-breaking thing, but this is a trouble, and eventually military commanders don't want more trouble than it's necessary. They basically prefer things to go smoothly. And if things in some place go not very smoothly, they say, really, we don't have to bother that much about this spot. Hell with it. Let them move.
Mm-hmm. You were in Israel a few weeks ago before you left on holidays. What is your current impression of a possible attack on Iran?
Well, that's a complicated question. I would say myself that, let's say, there are, in my opinion, 80 chances out of 100 that there will be no attack on Iran. Okay. But there is still 20 out of 100 that there will. So let's say, I think you can bet 4-1 that there will be no war. But still, somebody can make a longer shot and to bet 1-4 that there will.
Or manipulate it even.
It's difficult, you know, to decide totally. Though the feeling is that it passed by this kind of war. But others say, no, it's not over. There will be still another good chance to attack Iran. There will be still a good chance to attack Iran between the American elections and inauguration of the new president. But I mean, basically, who knows? Or some people say it could happen even tomorrow. But that's what I say. In my view, it's not very likely.
Not for, I don't think so. Israel, you released a new book. Tell us about your new book, Masters of Discourse.
Yes, that's a new book, and you can buy it on the Amazon. That's kind of really nice book, not too expensive, and that is basically the third now what I wrote mainly is packed in three neat volumes. One of them is called the Galilee Flowers, and another one is called Kabbalah of Power, and the third one is Masters of Discourse. Masters of Discourse is a sort of a book which tries to answer all the questions that you ask today, and others trying to go as far as possible, speaking as much as openly as possible about all those kind of subjects of interest. So I think that's a book, if somebody was interested in what we spoke about, that he will find in this book many, many interesting points.
So you can get that from Amazon. I see you have a link on your site, www.israelshamir.net. And you can get some of his audios and some of their Galileo Flowers and your other books are available on your site. Plus a lot of other information in your different articles. Is there anything? What are you looking into at the moment, or are you just enjoying and relaxing your holiday?
No. I keep writing all the time and publishing something all the time. Now the previous one was I wrote a very long article. It's on my website on the top, that is in defense of Noam Chomsky, who was very much attacked by some people, and in my view very unfairly attacked, and then it brought out a big general discussion about 9/11. So if some of the listeners would be interested, they would be able to see, to follow the arguments. And you know, in our site we have very, very open discussions, so people can express all sorts of views in support and against and whatnot. And the result obviously was very, very interesting. You know, it's good when people express different views, and in such a way we get a better understanding of the world. And now I also wrote, I finished today, about something else, about some developments within Israel, kind of Israeli political developments. There is also a big fight within Israel which is connected to one of the hidden hands acting in Israeli politics. The hidden hand is that of the judges, Supreme Court judges.
Okay.
You know, they are very, very active behind the scene in Israel. And that's what something I kind of thought should be written about, to describe this very peculiar setup. But I mean, you know, in the United States also, the judges of the Supreme Court, of the High Court, they are also very, very, they influence the events very much.
Well, they're selected, they're well placed.
Yes, they are selected.
Is that the same in Israel? Is that the same situation in Israel? Are they selected for the job?
They asked, well, in Israel it was particularly interesting because they were selected by themselves. In Israel, the Supreme Court actually selects the new judges. And in such a way, it turned out that they are all people mainly of one and the same mold. And they started to feel themselves superior to all the rest because they also abrogated to themselves the right to interpret Israeli law. And they did it in their own way and eventually succeeded to break down practically every Israeli politician. Now, I don't say that Israeli politicians are especially wonderful, but these guys are not especially wonderful either. So that is something which is of interest to whoever follows Israeli politics.
Israel, what in your opinion is their agenda?
Well, the different groups have different agenda. If we speak about those people in the Supreme Court, they are, let's say, acting in Israel in a way similar to what their counterparts act in the United States. So they are mildly anti-religious. They are very much kind of, let's say, have pro-American view of the world, and what they really don't like, they don't like let's say, they don't like men making decisions. They want now it happens that head of the Supreme Court is a woman, not just a woman, but a very, very militant feminist. So in Israel now we have in a way a feminist rule, something that would be difficult to understand. And but you know, feminist rule is not always such a blessing as people would think it is. Though we used to think that women are, you know, compassionate, nice people, nice creatures, better than we. But not always, not always. Some of those feminists are as bad as men and maybe a good deal worse.
Absolutely. Oh, but I think that goes for all countries, UK, that the legal profession is very and having used lawyers and solicitors myself. It's not really a world unless you're rich and powerful.
That is very peculiar world, and they also keep very much themselves, let's say, withdrawn from the public eye. And but in Israel, it happened such peculiar loop of power because they are self-elected. They are also very much tied up with the media. In a way, it's not dissimilar to what you had in America, let's say, in the days of Wade versus Roe and all that, when there was a general feeling that the judges are very, very liberal and they are very much undermining society in order to create some kind of different world, which is maybe not all that convenient for anybody.
Any direct links in your opinion, from your knowledge of between the Israeli justice system and the American justice system?
Well, you know, I wouldn't be able to kind of to say all that much. There are obviously so many differences. Like in America, they have the jury, and we don't have jury. So there is, you know, many, many differences. And the U.S. system changed during the last 50 years, while the Israeli one still incorporates some kind of things from the colonial past. Mm-hmm. So obviously there is a very, very big difference. But what happened now that the Israeli system got, legal system got a lot of this kind of feminist stuff. I would say even some kind of ascendancy of lesbians, if you want. Very unusual. But I mean, who knows? You saw so many movies where all those, you know, girls that kick men all the time in the movies, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe this fantasy was also is about to be materialized now in Israel.
Or is there maybe an Israeli or Jewish openness to what is considered, which wouldn't be as well perceived as, say, for example, in America, homosexuality?
You know, and I must admit that I lost my voice. Can we continue on some other day and call it a day for enough for today?
No problem, Israel. Listen, thank you very, very much. You can find Israel, israelshamir.net. Israel, listen, thank you very much for your time. Enjoy the rest.
Thank you very much. It was a great pleasure, but I just lost my voice.
No problem. I'll talk to you very soon.
Okay, bye.
So that was Israel Shamir, interesting as always. He's very pro-Palestinian from his writings, at least, and he seems like a very genuine, nice guy, and it's always interesting to have him on. He has another take, he's given me a few takes on other things. I think in our particular movement and this anti-Zionist, as we describe it, he called it something else. He said the people in Israel aren't Zionists anymore, but the words seem to mean a lot. And it's good. I wouldn't have a problem interviewing somebody that was very pro-Israeli, pro-Jewish, or pro-Zionist. Part of what my show is about is this getting the information out there and helping people, you know, look into certain things and decide, you know, that the world is a little bit screwy, and that if you look into it, you will find certain culprits, and you'll find them all down through history. And I'll leave you a bit of music. Next interview coming up soon. You catch us on the infounderground.com and come into the forums. Nice to come in, sign up, say hello. You need to sign up if you want to get the direct downloads from the archives in direct download format, or you can usually get them on different BitTorrent websites.
Hey!